There is much we can learn from a beautiful young woman about 2,500 years ago who remained faithful to her God, even though the circumstances of her life were not ideal in her book. She exuded the faithfulness of Joseph. She had a huge decision to make in terms of what she would do. We ended last week, chapter 4. She says to Mordecai, her cousin, "Go gather all the Jews who are present at Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day, humbled before God, no distraction, singular focus upon the Almighty, prayer, the slender nerve that moves the hand of omnipotence." She said, "My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." And so, for the sake of her people, Esther goes to the king unsummoned. She enters into the inner court of the king's palace, not knowing if she would emerge again. Chapter 5. It happened the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing at the court that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. She stood in the inner court. Usually what happens is if somebody wanted an audience with the king, they would stand in the outer court. And we will see that later on, as is recorded in the text. But if the king wanted to invite them into the inner court, he would say, "Let them come in." Esther walked right into the inner court without a summons from the king. You can just hear it as she walks in. There might have been some conversation with the king's wise men and counselors, and the door opens and in walks Esther in her royal garb. And the king had not summoned anyone to come in, and you can just hear it, the guards drawing their swords. And they're ready to engage whoever is walking through the door because the king has not called anyone. And Esther stands there trembling. But the king grants her favor. And he gives mercy. And he reaches out the golden scepter and she touches that. And the second point in Esther's courage is that she came to ask the king something very important. And the king knew that. Else, why would she decide to break the law and come into the inner court of the king? And so the king asks her, "What do you wish? What is your request?" Clearly, there was something very urgent and important on her mind that she would decide to break the law in this fashion. The king assumed a very urgent request for her to appear in this way. Let it be made known very clearly, Esther didn't risk her life just to invite the king to dinner. And he knew that. But nevertheless, she gives him an invitation to the banquet. Now, again, remember that King Ahasuerus was a very voluptuous king. He loved his luxury. And she invited him to a banquet. She knew how to get to him. She knew how to get his attention. That was very wise on her part. And so she invites him to the banquet. And she says, "King, I want it to be just you and Haman." Very interesting what he says there. He says, "Bring Haman quickly." Look at verse 5. "Then the king said, 'Bring Haman quickly that he may do as Esther has said.'" You see, the king knew his priorities. Food, I'm there. Let's go right now. Right? And so make those preparations. Bring Haman quickly. Eating great food is an urgent matter to this king. Now, the second point, we come to Haman's indignation. We see them at the banquet that evening in verses 6 through 8. And Esther invites them to another banquet. And then something interesting happens in verse 9. They've come out from the banquet, their bellies full. They've had their fill of drink. So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. You know what that means? Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. How does that line end? Everything's what? Going my way. That's what Haman thought. We have a tendency to do that, don't we? When things are going just exactly the way we want them to be, we lose sight of the big picture. Because as soon as Mordecai was walking out singing, he was merry, he was happy, he was joyful, enter Mordecai on the scene. Mordecai was a Jew. Haman was an Agagite, an Amalekite, an enemy of the Jews from of old, from as much as 1,000 years before. And God had promised that he would be at war with the Amalekites from generation to generation. So what happens? He sees Mordecai at the king's gate, and he did not stand or tremble before him. He was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Now, Haman, unbelievably, verse 10, expresses a little bit of self-restraint and went home, and he sent and called his friends and his wife Zeresh. It's amazing the role that his wife plays in all of this. Verse 11, Haman told them of his great riches. Why did he need to do this? You see, his self-esteem needed to be propped up. There was one man that ruined it for him. Boy, we have a tendency to do that, don't we? So much good can be happening, and yet there can be one person who, like a Paul's thorn in the flesh. There are some that believe that Paul's thorn in the flesh in 2 Corinthians was a person, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, who kept him humble. I don't know that that's what it was. But Mordecai was certainly a thorn in the flesh of Haman. And he couldn't ignore it. And he says, I must have things going my way, and I will see to it that I have my way. A little bit of self-preeminence there. Verse 11, Haman told them, he goes home, his servants and his wife, he tells them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything which the king had promoted him, and how he advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king. He's telling others how great he is. He's promoting his own self-importance. And you'll look at what he says in verse 13. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. His own self-preeminence needed to be propped up because he recognized the accuracy of what Mordecai was doing. And he was convicted by it. And it got under his skin. Second point there under main subject number two, Haman's indignation, the destructive power of self-preeminent pride. Now listen, let's not just talk about Haman. These things are written for our instruction. We are human beings just as much as he was. And we have to battle these kinds of things. And in Christ we have the capacity to battle them, but it's war, and we have to wage war against self-preeminent pride. And we can in Christ. Self-preeminent pride says, I deserve to be treated better than this. That's what self-preeminent pride says. And when we think in that groove is when we focus our efforts and emotional energy on guaranteeing that we are treated as we ought to be. Instead of entrusting ourselves to God, instead of committing ourselves to doing what He has commanded us to do, if we are focused on the one who is not treating us the way we deserve to be treated, we will focus all of our energy and emotional efforts, all of our efforts and emotional energy on guaranteeing that we are. And that is a path of self-destruction. Because what did his wife and his servants recommend to him? Make gallows, Haman. Let's build some gallows. Let's hang Mordecai. Let's just get him out of the way. This guy's getting under your skin. Get him out of the way. You see, what we have here is a narrow zoom. It's what I've spoken of before. You know, your life, you're looking at life through like this camcorder. And there is so much good happening. And when a negative comes, what we in our humanness have the propensity to do, that we zoom in on the one negative. And that's all we see. That's all we're focused upon. And as we zoom in and focused and fixed are on that, we ignore, we block out all the good that is happening around us and the faithfulness of God and His purposes. And we're focused on the negative. God, rescue us from that. You know, it's kind of like if I were up here with this shirt, you know, well coordinated. My wife dresses me well, doesn't she? I guess. But if I had this shirt up, if this tie, look at this, isn't this a nice tie? Say, mm-hmm, thank you. If all the food that I ate yesterday had dripped on this tie, and there was a big blob right here, and I was standing up here talking to you, where would you be focused? You would. You admit it. See? I know by your giggles. You would admit you'd be focused on that spot. That's a human propensity, isn't it? We're so easily distracted. And we can be by such things. And that's what happens with the narrow zoom. And we become, we again, what that happens is when we do that is we fix our efforts and our emotional energy on handling and taking care of that one bad thing that I don't want in my life. And then we take it to God and say, God, please remove this bad thing from my life. And remember what the Lord said to Paul, the Apostle Paul, when he talked about the thorn in the flesh. He said what? My what? Grace is sufficient for you. God says to him, my strength is made perfect in your weakness. We sometimes can be so fixed on removing everything bad from our lives that we expend all of our energy in doing that, that we marginalize the purposes that God has for us. Now let's consider chapter 6 here. That night the king could not sleep. I like the way Josephus puts it. He says, he's speaking of God. He says, that night, he took away the king's sleep. You see, the sovereign withheld sleep from the king. Coincidence that just that night, it was the very next morning that this Haman was going to come into his outer court and say, King, we need to hang Mordecai. He's one of those people that doesn't obey your laws. The Lord took away the king's sleep that night. And he brings out the king's chronicles. These are the things that have happened recently. And they talk about Mordecai, who exposed a plot against the king's life. And the guy who's reading him, you know, here it is, 2 o'clock in the morning, and the servant is reading these chronicles, and he says, and Mordecai exposed this plot against these two men. And then he goes on to the next subject, and the king says, wait a minute. What happened for Mordecai? Was any recognition given him? No, nothing, Your Honor, nothing. And it got the king thinking. You know, what can, little application here. What do you do with insomnia? Has anybody here ever had a hard time sleeping at night? Could it be that it's not just a physical thing? Have you ever considered that? Consider sometime that it's not just a physical thing. Could it be that sometimes God wants to keep you awake? My question is, what do you do with insomnia? What can you do? Let me give you a few recommendations. Number one, read. And don't just read anything. Careful what you graze your mind on. Okay? Read God's Word. Recount. Secondly, recount what God has done. Do you ever take the time to just sit and reflect on the faithfulness of God and what God has done? We are so busy today in our lives, aren't we? that we never take the time to just sit back and think, what has happened? What happened this day? How has God been at work in my life? If maybe the Lord has taken sleep from you, read. Sit down in a comfortable chair and read. And then recount what God has done. And then thirdly, request. Pray. Make supplication for the saints at 2 o'clock in the morning if you can't sleep. I've heard it said before that if you do these things and you're suffering from insomnia, that your adversary, the devil, will do all he can in his power to give you a good night's sleep. Loved ones, don't take this lightly. I'm adding some humor to it. But let's not just assume that all of our troubles are just physical things. The Lord took the king's sleep away. And because of that, what we have next is an unexpected turn of affairs. Mordecai's heroism was recognized. It was in the record, and it needed to be recognized. No honor was bestowed upon this. And so here comes in Haman early in the morning to give the king the recommendation that Mordecai needs to be hanged. And so he stands in the outer court, as Esther should have done, but she walked right into the inner court. Haman stands in the outer court, and the king says, there's somebody in the outer court. Who's there? Let him come on in. And so Haman comes right on in, and he's about to say, O king, live forever. And before he says a word, the king says, Haman, what should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? I can't think of anybody the king would want to honor more than me. That's a dangerous assumption. What is his presumptuous assumption here? It's all about me. You see, his whole life was viewed in terms of how it relates to me. He never even took the thought of somebody else whom the king might want to honor. It's all about me. And so Mordecai gives him the recommendation, King, this is what you should do. You take this man and you put a robe on him that you have worn. Talk about a high honor. Not just anybody can wear the king's robe. And you set him on your horse with the king's shield on that horse, and you parade him around town, and you say, this is what will be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And of course, all this time, Haman has who sitting on the horse? Himself. How convenient. And as he is saying this, the king says, good, Haman, go do it. And Haman turns around, yes, sir, for Mordecai. What'd you say, O king? Or as Gary Coleman would say, what you talking about? Wouldn't you just love to be a fly on the wall there? I mean, there's so many occasions in this book. Again, all those coincidences, that we would call them, it is so God at work. And so he does it. You see, there is the deceptive power of self-talk. There's not only the destructive power of self-preeminent pride, but there's the deceptive power of self-talk. God tells us in his word that the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked, and who can know it? Listen, folks, we must recognize that. Our hearts can deceive us. And Haman's heart deceived him. And so he had to parade his enemy, Mordecai, on the king's horse with the king's robe around town. And when it was done, he goes back. You know, and everybody knew what was going on between Haman and Mordecai. They said, wow, this is fascinating. What brought this on? And then they were all done, and of course Mordecai, okay, that's nice. He goes back to his duties, and Haman goes home. How does it describe him? His head covered. A little bit of humiliation there, just a little bit, right? chapter 6, verses 12 to 14. Afterwards, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to the house, mourning with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, can you just hear him? I mean, how would you imagine Haman's disposition right now? I mean, guys, you talk about wine city. He was marinating in his wine. All this stuff has happened to me. I can't believe it. Can this day get any worse? Yes. In fact, it can. Now, you would think after something bad like that happens, you'd go home and your home would be a haven for you, right? And your friends and your wife would sympathize with you and they would comfort you and say, "That's okay, dear. Things are going to get better." Well, look at verse 13. His wife said to him, "Read God all through this, people. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but you will surely fall before him." Do you know what's represented in that second half of verse 13? It is the reputation of Jehovah God. The promises that he has made, and the people knew the character of Jehovah God. And they knew full well that the Jews were not in this land because God had abandoned them. They knew that they were there because God sent them there because of their own disobedience. Boy, friends like that, I can just hear Haman walking out. What do they know? Friends like that, who needs enemies, right? Haman, you're falling before this guy. There's no stopping this. He's like, "I didn't need to hear that. I need something better." Well, fortunately, he had been invited to another banquet. And this takes us to chapter 7. Because at the end of chapter 6, while they were still talking, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet. See, you know, again, the urgency of getting to where the food is. Comfort food. Do you ever get to the point where you feel, "I deserve to indulge a little bit"? I know you've been there. You know why? Because I've been there. We all think that sometimes, don't we? "I've been through so much, I deserve to just take a break and indulge a little bit." Well, that's where Haman was. "Ah, at least I'm going to a banquet. I'm invited to the second banquet with just me and the king and Esther. Ha! Who needs you guys?" Well, there goes Haman to the banquet. And so the king knew that Esther had an urgent request for him. And he says, you know, like usual, "Up to half my kingdom." I wonder if anybody ever asked for that, don't you? Anyway, that's an aside. But he did mention it twice. But the plea, this is very important. Then Queen Esther, the king says in verse 2, he says, "I shall grant it to you. What is your petition, Queen Esther?" Verse 3, Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed and to be killed and to be annihilated." And then she continues to say, "Had we just been sold as slaves, we'd have been fine with that. We know what that's like. We've been there. We're there." But no, this enemy wants to annihilate us, to do away with us. Now again, this is another one of those situations where there's just the three of them in the room. And you hear the clang on the plates of people eating and chewing and drinking and slurping and all this kind of stuff. And Esther makes this request, and then all of a sudden it becomes deadly quiet. Haman's not eating right now. And the king's attention has been gotten. And a light starts coming on. He just signed a petition not long ago to annihilate a whole people group in his empire. And the king's light starts coming on. And then he asks, "Who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." Now he's trembling. The adversary, and Haman is terrified. The tide has turned. And the king, the light comes on for the king, and he says, "So that's what you have been up to." He trusted Haman a little too much, and Haman had pulled the wool over his eyes. And so the king is now in a rage. He is so angry with Haman, he walks out of the room. Meanwhile, back in the room, there's Haman alone with Esther, and guess who's begging for his life? The one who created the decree that all the Jews should be annihilated. And he's falling down in front of Esther. Esther is probably on this luxurious couch, and Haman is coming over to her, and he's praying, just falling over the couch. "Oh, Queen Esther, please have mercy on him." The problem with this is he experienced a little bit of bad posture at exactly the wrong time. He's falling down on the couch as soon as King Ahasuerus is coming in the room. Well, you know, what's the king going to think? He's attacking my queen. Long story short, off with his head. Well, you know, hang it in the gallows. But it happened to be the gallows that Haman made for Mordecai. Take him out. You see, the evil that he had planned on one of God's people came back on himself. Where is God's reputation in this? I mentioned it before. Let's think about God's reputation. Because it was well known to the people. Two things become very clear in this. First of all, in terms of God's reputation, is His justice. The reputation of God is that God is a just God. And God speaks of the fall of the wicked. That the wicked will be overruled in the end. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked came against me to eat up my flesh, my enemies and foes, they stumbled and fell. The sovereign Creator, who is just, will prevail. And there is no stopping it. Do you believe that? That is his reputation. Much later on, about another 4.5 centuries, in the temple in Jerusalem, there was an old man called Simeon. And he held in his arms the one who was the Christ child, the Messiah. And he recognized him. And he said, concerning this one, he said, "This child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel." He held in his arms the incarnate sovereign God. Think about that. And what he made clear by that statement was that one's humanity plummets or is raised to exalted heights based on his or her relation to this one, this child, the Son of God. God is just. This one is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel. Many will fall. It's like last Sunday night, talking about kicking a tank. Resisting God is like kicking a tank. The one who kicks the tank, who is it that gets hurt? Certainly not the tank. The reputation of God is that the wicked will fall. Secondly, the reputation of God is His faithfulness. God is faithful to His own character. He is faithful to His promises. And the Jews were under sovereign protection. And the people around them knew that. God's reputation was clear. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. What are they saying there? God is like what God has done. He has sovereignly protected the Jews, and we recognize that the Jews are in Shushan, and they're in this empire not because God failed them, but because God sent them here to teach them. You can't fight against this, Haman. It's not going to happen. You will not win. Haman didn't listen, or it was too late for him to listen anyway. You know, that goes all the way back to the up to the New Testament. Paul said it very clearly. Finish the phrase for me. If God is for us, that is a profound truth, people. Do you believe that? If God is for us, who can be against us? Let me turn that around. If God is against you, who can be for you? No one. Because God's reputation is that He resists the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. The closing verse today, 1 Peter 4:19. Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to Him in doing good as to a faithful Creator. The level of your commitment to God reflects the magnitude of His reputation in your heart and mind. How do you know God? In what way do you know Him? Is He just? Is He faithful? Do you understand that about Him? To the level that I understand that and know that about God, I will commit myself to Him. To the Christ child. To the Christ, the Messiah. The one who made me and also the one who died for me.